over here. He motioned to the left where all Fiona could see was overgrown weeds and got a view of the road. It was dark and Creel didn't see me. His cruiser was parked on the side of the road. He got in and the interior light went on for a second and I saw Tim Christopher. Clear as I'm looking at you right now, sitting in the fucking police cruiser with the chief of fucking police. Then Creel turned the car around and drove away. Her head pounded. This was like a crazy dream. Tim Christopher in Garrett's police cruiser, and 20 years later, through the media coverage and the trial, no one had heard it. "Why would you lie about this?" she asked Lionel. "What reason would you have?"
"Why would I lie about anything?" Lionel said. "Ask around about me, Sheridan girl. Ask your daddy if you want. I'm an open book, always have been."
"Then why wasn't any of this evidence in Tim's case?"
"Because I was told to shut up about it," Lionel said. "Clearly, by people who meant business. Those kids never saw Garrett's car, but they saw Garrett. He lectured them, but when they were interviewed, not one of them mentioned it, because the people who got to me got to them. It was Garrett's force, and they were Garrett's cops, every last one of them. None of them was honest. Kids are easily scared. I'm not, but I know when to shut up for survival, and that was one of those times."
He looked at her carefully.
"Besides, they got him. Tim Christopher's been in jail for 20 years. I had to choose the lesser evil."
His gaze cut over her shoulder, and she heard the hum of a motor.
"Come to speak it, I think the greater evil is on its way."
Fiona turned to see a boxy brown Chevy come up the drive and stop behind her own car, the engine idling. The driver's door opened, and the big, heavy frame of Garrett Creel unwound itself from the driver's seat and stood. He stared at her, squinting through the flakes of snow in the gray light.
"Fiona,"
he said, his voice mild, ignoring Lionel Charters.
"You don't look so good, dear."
Fiona looked at Lionel. His face was unreadable. He said nothing. He still cradled the rifle.
I'm okay," she said to Garrett, forcing the words out past her sore throat.
The wind blew down the neck of her coat, and she shivered. Garrett shook his head.
"I don't think so. You're gray as a sheet. There's something going around, you know."
He nodded.
"Something real bad."
Her brain tried to work. Why was Garrett here? What did he want? But it was starting to feel like someone had placed hot coals in the spot where her skull met the back of her neck, and she felt sweat trickling down her back the same time as she shivered with cold.
"I just need some aspirin," she managed.
"I don't think you should be driving, dear," Garrett said.
He hadn't called her dear before, and something about it repulsed her.
"You look too sick. I'll take you home."
"Garrett," Lionel said.
"Shut up, Lionel, or I'll have you shut down,"
Garrett said casually.
"Those junkies you let stay in your trailer, you think the cops won't find a fucking pharmacy if they raid that place?"
"My trailer is for people going clean," Lionel said. "You know that."
"Going clean," Garrett said. "Sure, like that son of yours. Died with enough coke in him to kill someone twice his size. Sounds clean to me."
Fiona could feel the hostility radiating from Lionel like a vibration.
"Get off my property," he said. "You're not police anymore. You're not anything. This is private property. I own it. Get off." "You broke our deal, Lionel,"
Garrett said.
"It took you 20 years, but you broke it. You talked. I thought Fiona might find you ever since she came to dinner at my house, full of accusations. So I've had a few of my friends keep an eye on her as a favor to me. Turns out, I called it right. We're leaving now."
He stepped forward,
his footsteps loud on the gravel in the cold air. He put a big hand on Fiona's upper arm. "Come with me," he said.
"Wait," Fiona said. There was a click, and she turned to see that Lionel had raised his rifle, aiming it at Garrett.
"You let her go," he said.
Garrett didn't even flinch.
"Are you gonna shoot me?"
he asked.
"You can't aim for shit. You'll hit her first."
He pulled Fiona toward his car as she tried to pull from his grip.
"Go ahead, Lionel. Shoot at me. Kill Deb Sheridan's sister while you're at it. Then see how quick your little operation shuts down while you're in prison."
He opened his passenger door, and Fiona tried to twist out of his hold, but he had her tight, and he shoved her inside with practiced precision. "He's not going to hurt me," she told herself as she got in the other side. "He's Jamie's father. He was the chief of police. It's daylight, with a witness. He just wants to talk." Garrett started the car and reversed out of the lot. She looked out the window and could see Lionel Charters standing there, watching them, still aiming his gun. Chapter 30. Cece. Barrons, Vermont. December 1950. There was only one family visit day at the end of the year, held between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So on the second Sunday in December, the three girls left in Clayton Hall 3C sat quietly in their bunks, reading and studying in painful boredom. Cece was miserable. She was having nightmares, insomnia, trouble eating. Her days were a long, slow echo of grief for Sonia, of wondering what had happened to her, of wondering if it had hurt. She lay listlessly on her bed and watched Katie, who was leafing through one of their stolen magazines. Katie had been silent for a few days, but now she was acting as she always had, angry and sassy and beautiful and smart. It should have angered Cece that Katie had moved on from their friend's disappearance in less than a week, but it didn't, for the simple reason that it wasn't true. Cece had made a study of Katie, of her ways and thoughts and actions, a closer study than she'd done of any topic in their stupid textbooks. Katie was Cece's master's thesis and her Ph.D. If there was a test on the topic of all things Katie, Cece would have passed with flying colors. And Katie had not, in any way, moved on from Sonia's disappearance. She was pretending to be her old self to deflect attention, but it was a deception. Katie wasn't herself at all. Katie was angry. Cece watched her friend flip a page. Katie's up-tilted eyes were dark, and in Cece's opinion, ominous. Others saw a pretty girl who had a defiant attitude. Cece saw a white-hot fury that was banked so deeply, fed so carefully, that there was no way it would ever cease to burn. Roberta wasn't acting like her old self either. She'd gone quiet, pale, obviously in mourning for her friend. The teachers gave Roberta kindly concern instead of the hard mistrust they gave Katie and the irritated lectures they gave Cece about bucking up. But Cece saw the anger there, too, in the way Roberta sat still at meals and didn't speak, in the way her jaw twitched, in the way she tore around the hockey field with new viciousness she hadn't had before, as if she wanted to work her anger out through her muscles, the way she ground her teeth at night and jerked her hair into a braid with her deft fingers every morning, yanking at the strands until they obeyed. It didn't take a genius to see the anger in that. It was fine with Cece. She was angry, too. So horribly, horribly angry. She didn't know what to do with it. Channel it, like Katie, or suppress it, like Roberta. Cece's anger was like an overfilled balloon she couldn't tuck away and didn't want to touch for fear it would explode. It suffocated her, closed her throat so she couldn't breathe. She didn't have a sport to play to burn it out, and she didn't have Katie's wicked intelligence to plot whatever it was that Katie was plotting. All Cece could do was suffer. The problem was that she didn't have a target, because she didn't know who had killed Sonia. That Sonia was dead, Cece no longer had any doubt. She'd known the minute she'd seen the words, "Good night, girl," in the mirror. Had her great-aunt and great-uncle done it? If so, why was Sonia's suitcase found in the trees? Katie said that Mary Hand couldn't have done it, because Mary was a ghost, but Cece wasn't so sure. Cece had seen Mary from the bathtub, her dark, ominous form moving above her, wearing the black dress and veil. She had seen Mary bend down, felt the cold hand grasp her neck, hold her down under the water. Mary might have been long dead, but Cece had no doubt that Mary was capable of killing a girl and dragging her to wherever she lived, to haunt future Idlewild girls forever. Cece had no doubt of that at all. Besides, Mary walked the grounds, the woods, the road, and Mary had known Sonia was dead. She had told them with the message in the mirror. Cece pictured Sonia getting off the bus on Old Barron's Road, seeing Mary waiting for her. What had happened? Had Sonia screamed? Had she run? There was a knock on the door.
"Ladies!" came Lady Loon's voice. "Cecilia, you have a family visitor."
Cece groaned and rolled off her bed.
"I'm coming," she called through the door.
Roberta poked her face over the edge of her top bunk and looked over at her. "Who do you think it is?" she asked. Cece shrugged, noting the lavender half-circles beneath Roberta's eyes, which mirrored her own. She'd crawled into Roberta's bunk more than once in the past week, and the other girl hadn't minded. Cece slept better when they were together against the darkness, Roberta's larger, bonier body sprawled next to her in her thick nightgown.
"Joseph," Cece said listlessly, "my half-brother."
Katie's eyes flickered up from her magazine.
"Comb your hair," she said, "and straighten your shirt."
"Why?" Cece asked her. Katie stared hard at her.
"Look good for him."
Cece shrugged again, but she did what Katie ordered.
"I don't see the point. I don't even want to talk to him, not today. He's nice enough, but I don't have the energy."
"Make a good impression," Katie said. "Trust me." So Cece brushed her hair out and tied it back neatly, then readjusted her shirt so it didn't look as awkward over her bosom, and added a cardigan.
"I hate this," she said as she pulled on her shoes. "I'm lonely without her."
"Me too," Roberta said. They'd gone through Sonia's suitcase more than once, but it hadn't yielded any clues. It had only made them miss her more, picturing these same things when they'd seen them in Sonia's dresser or hanging on her hook, her bathroom things, her hairbrush. They could smell her. Their friend seemed so close. She couldn't possibly be dead, could she?
"If Joseph gives you another gift," Katie said, "accept it. Act shy. Do your dumb cow act. And don't tell him about Sonia."
Cece nodded. She didn't even have the energy to be angry about the dumb cow comment, because Katie was right. She should know by now that Katie saw everything. She didn't have to put up the act when they were in 3C. That was why they were friends. She took the stairs down and crossed the common to the dining hall, where the familiar tables were set up. This close to Christmas, very few families visited. Most girls got a visit home during the holidays, at least briefly, which made the December visit extraneous. "You wouldn't want to see your daughters too much," Cece thought with unfamiliar bitterness. "How awful that would be, especially when you took the trouble to send them away." Mrs. Peabody sat in the corner, yawning and reading a book. She was the assigned supervisor today. Jenny White sat with her parents, the three of them looking quiet and awkward, Jenny looking desperately out the window. Allison Garner was sitting with her mother, who was heavily pregnant and held a toddler in her lap, a little boy who crowed, opening and closing his hands as he leaned toward his big sister. and in the corner of the room, by the windows, stood Mary Hand.
Cece stopped, frozen, her breath in her throat. Mary wore her dress and veil and stood with her hands dangling.
Cece could feel the girl's stare through the impenetrable black of the veil, imagined Mary's thin, bony face, which no one had ever seen. Her bladder clenched and her palms turned to ice. Her face prickled with the numbness of terror.
Mary moved. She took a step forward and then another, walking across the room toward Cece.
Around them, nothing happened. Mrs. Peabody turned a page. Jenny looked out the window. Allison's little brother cooed.
"Run, everyone!" Cece wanted to scream. "Run!"
But she realized, as Mary took another step, that none of them could see.
"She's come for me," she thought, "just like she did in the bath."
She'd managed to scream in the bath, managed to push her face out of the water and make so much noise that every girl on the floor had come running. But now, with Mary walking across the room toward her, she couldn't make a sound.
Mary's dress moved as she walked, and inside Cece's head, deep in her brain, she heard a voice.
"My baby. My little girl."
Her mouth fell open helplessly, sound dying in her throat. She glanced past Mary to the window behind her. Of course, the garden. That was why Mary was by the window, because her baby was buried in the garden.
"Someone help me, please," she thought.
"My little girl,"
Mary said, coming closer. Cece could see the ruched fabric of her old-fashioned dress, the bony remnants of her hands dangling at her sides.
"Darling, darling."
Finally, Cece screamed. The sound was so loud, the blood rushing so viciously in her ears, that she barely heard the room's reaction, the scraping of a chair, the exclamation from the teacher, the frightened screeching of the baby. She opened her mouth and let the scream out until it rubbed her throat raw. Warmth trickled down her leg, and she realized, vaguely, that her bladder had let go. Hands grabbed her, and Mrs. Peabody was shaking her, her voice coming from far away. "Cecilia! Cecilia!" Cold air slapped Cece's face, an angry, icy draft. Cece blinked, turned her head, and stared again. Mary Hand was gone. In her place stood a woman. It took a long, agonized second before Cece recognized her own mother, wearing a dress of winter wool, her coat buttoned to the throat, a scarf around her neck, her usual handbag in her hand. Her hair was tied back as it always was, and a look of frightened concern was on her thin, lined face.
"Darling," she cried. "Darling!"
The hands in the bathtub, pushing her down. Her mother's hands, holding her under the water, the salty ocean filling Cece's eyes and nose and lungs as she struggled to move. Mary knew everything. Mary saw everything. Everything. Even the things you didn't say to yourself, deep in your own mind, ever. Mary knew the truth. And when she appeared, she showed it to you. Even when the truth was that your own mother wanted to kill you, that your own mother had already tried, that even though you'd blocked it out, deep down you'd always known. This was what had happened to Sonia. This was what she'd seen when she'd gotten off the bus. She'd seen Mary, and behind the mask of Mary, the person who would kill her, just like Cece had. And Sonia had run as long and as fast as she could, dropping her suitcase, except she hadn't run fast or long enough. Cece looked at her mother's shocked face, felt the puddle growing on the floor beneath her, listened to the baby scream, and started to cry.
Chapter 31. Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. Garrett drove in silence as his car bumped down the drive and onto Old Barrons Road. Fiona leaned back against the seat, pain throbbing up the back of her neck into her skull.
Despite the blast of the heater, her hands and feet couldn't get warm.
"What did Lionel say to you?"
Garrett said after a minute.
"What?" Fiona managed.
"You know he's an old druggie, right?"
Garrett said.
"Him and his son both. His son blew his brains out. With coke, but he blew his brains out just the same. Lionel has pulled this recovering bullshit for 30 years, but I know better. Do you understand?"
"He seemed honest to me," Fiona said.
"He's a liar," Garrett said, and she felt him turn toward her. "Fiona, you have to tell me what he said to you. Right now."
She would never forget it as long as she lived. "He said you were in the car with Tim Christopher the night my sister died," she said. "That it was your car." She looked around. Not this car. No, it wasn't this car. Garrett had been a cop then, and it had been a cruiser. "That was why no one saw Tim's car that night," she said, the words forming slowly. "They saw a cop car instead. But that doesn't make sense. Because you didn't kill Deb."
"Of course I didn't kill your sister," Garrett said.
"Tim did," Fiona said, repeating it to herself, because this was the truth. Despite everything, despite 20 years of searching and doubting, despite the confusion and the pain, despite what felt like hot pokers inserted into her brain, this was the truth that had not changed. She rearranged the facts, and then, in a brief flash, her mind worked, and she understood. All that talk about Tim being railroaded was bullshit. Tim killed her, but it was you who helped him clean it up, just like you did with Helen Heyer. Garrett sighed.
"It was a long time ago, Fiona,"
he said, as if she were bringing up some petty grievance.
20 goddamned years.
"What was it?" Fiona asked him.
Fear was in her throat, on the back of her tongue. She should never have gotten in the car with him. She should run, but the car was moving. He sat with his hands on the wheel, navigating them over the bumpy back road, and he didn't even look angry. "What was the agreement? Tim killed girls and then he called you to clean it up for him?"
"Believe me, I didn't like playing janitor," Garrett said, "but it had to be done. The Christophers were important people around here, good people. Tim had a great future. I did favors for them. They did favors for me. That's how it works. They had a lot of pull, and if I didn't help, they'd have replaced me with someone who would. I couldn't exactly turn them down. And in the end, it didn't even work, did it? All that risk, all that danger to cover him up, and Tim has been in prison for 2 decades.
He sounded disgusted.
I risked everything. My career, everything. And just because he got sloppy, they blamed me. After everything I did for them, for Tim, I thought we were friends, colleagues, family even. They felt more like family than my own wife and son. But Tim screwed up. And suddenly, if any of it had come out in court, they'd have hung me out to dry without a second thought. That's what happens when you deal with certain types of people, Fiona. They use you, and they don't thank you. They just get what they want from you for as long as they can."
Fiona stared at him as his words washed over her in waves.
"What do you mean he got sloppy?"
He glanced at her.
"I guess I shouldn't have said that, since she was your sister. I'm just trying to be straight with you here, and I need you to be straight with me."
She felt like screaming.
"What do you mean, he got sloppy?"
"Calm down. I'm not talking about a serial killer here. He had a temper, that's all, and some girls made him mad. Helen, I couldn't do anything about Helen, but no one had ever seen him with her. So it was easy to drop it."
He glanced at Fiona again.
"But your sister, I knew from the minute they called me that Tim was done. Her father was a journalist, for God's sake. Everyone had seen them fighting, had seen her get in his car. Tim called me and said she'd made him mad. It had gone too far, and I had to help him fix it. Someone would be looking for her soon. I had to think fast, and I didn't have a lot of options. We had no chance to take her over the state line.
Deb, Fiona thought. My God, Deb.
The Christophers owned Idlewild then, Garrett went on. I thought we'd dump her there, quick, and I'd be able to go back later and do it proper without attracting any suspicion. It was the only thing I could think of to do. So we moved the body from Tim's car to my cruiser, and while he dumped her, I distracted Lionel and the kids at the drive-in. I told Tim to hide her in the trees, but the idiot had to put her in the middle of the field like she was a goddamn display. A rush job. He just dropped her and ran, even after I told him not to. How stupid can you be?
Deb, lying in that field, her shirt ripped open, dropped like trash in the middle of the field, waiting to be seen. Mary Hand, dead and buried under land. Fiona's head hurt so much.
It was a goddamn clusterfuck, Garrett Creel went on. She wouldn't have been found so fast if she wasn't in the field, and I would have had the chance to move her. But someone found her. I had to clean it all up, everything. I had to make sure his footprints were erased when we searched for evidence in the trees.
Richard Rush, Fiona said, remembering the man who owned Pop's ice cream. He saw Tim at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but you told him to say he saw Tim at 9.
Fuck him. Garrett spit, angry now. His shop was in debt, and I promised he'd be square if he did what I said. Instead, he bailed out on me when he realized he'd be called as a witness at trial, said he wouldn't commit perjury because of his kids. That was Tim's best chance at reasonable doubt, flushed straight down the toilet.
So many details. So many. Garrett had thought of them all. The kids at the drive-in, she said. They saw you that night. You came and lectured them while Tim dumped the body.
That was easier. I tracked them down and told them that if they said anything about seeing me, I'd pin them on drug charges, underage drinking. I wore my uniform when I sat them down, and I brought another cop with me, intimidating as hell. Every one of them shit their pants and shut up. Lionel was tougher, but I just threatened to burn down his fucking business because I knew he didn't have a penny of insurance. And in the end, you know what? Tim went to jail anyway.
He glanced at her, his gaze furious, his face red.
People are so stupid, don't you see? Maybe I sound crazy, but for 30 years it was just so goddamn easy. Nothing ever came back on me, not once. What is it with people? Why don't they see?
Fiona looked out the window. They weren't driving back into town. They had turned onto another side road, past the south end of Idlewild.
Even my own son, Garrett said.
His neck was flushed red where it emerged from his parka, and his hands were tight on the wheel.
I always wanted Jamie to be a cop, but he wasn't on the force a year before I realized he wasn't going to be like me. I did my best to raise him right, but he doesn't have the instincts I do. He isn't hard enough. He still thinks he can do right by everyone. Tim had brains and guts, at least until that last night. Until that night, I always thought Tim should have been my son instead of Jamie.
Jamie knows about Helen, Fiona almost said, but she stopped herself. She didn't think Garrett knew yet that Jamie had pulled the Helen Heyer file, that he'd seen a shoddy investigation under his father's name. Let me out of the car.
Oh, I don't think so, Garrett said. You haven't been listening. My son dating a journalist, Malcolm Sheridan's daughter, Deb Sheridan's sister. It isn't going to happen. You're too close. I thought you'd flake out and leave him, let him find a nice girl, but you didn't take your chance. And now look what you've put your nose into, of all things. After 20 fucking years, you could ruin everything for me, for the whole force, for Barron's, because you just can't quit. Jamie will never have the goddamn guts to get rid of you. But I do.
Terror bloomed in Fiona's agonized brain, yet above it she was strangely calm. He was going to kill her. He thought it was the only way to keep his secrets. He needed no other reason. Maybe he'd killed before. She didn't know, and it didn't matter. He was going to kill her now. She could beg and plead and reason, but it wouldn't work. He'd chosen a course, and he was going to follow it. That was reality, right now. She unsnapped her seatbelt, opened the car door, and jumped before she could form another thought. The road was so rutted that the car wasn't going very fast. She landed hard on her shoulder, the gravel ripping through her winter coat and the knee of her jeans. Her palms were scraped raw, and she rolled wildly into the ditch on the side of the road, thick with wet leaves and ice-crusted mud. She heard the car swerve to a stop, and she got up, climbed out of the ditch, and started to run. The sky overhead was dark, looming gray, the trees stark black against it. She was on the edge of an open field, and even in the depths of her fever, fear, and pain, she knew instinctively that Idlewild was a mile in this direction and town was the other way. She took off across the field as fast as she could, her boots digging into the soft, half-frozen earth. She could try for the gas station at the top of the hill, but Idlewild was closer, and she remembered seeing workers there when she'd driven past it, machines moving. He caught her quickly. He was bigger than she was, stronger, his legs longer. He drove her to the ground and jammed his knee into her stomach, his face looming over her. "I knew you would do this," he shouted at her, his face red, his features distorted with rage. "I knew it." He put his hands on her throat and squeezed. Fiona bucked beneath him, trying to get away, but he was so much bigger, so much stronger. Spots bloomed behind her eyes. She beat at him with her fists and stared past his shoulder, where crows wheeled in a sky dark with falling snow, and thought, "I'm not going to die like Deb. I'm not." She twisted her hips beneath him and brought her knee up hard into his stomach. When he grunted and his grip on her neck slipped, she kicked him again and again. He reared back to hit her, and she smashed a hand into his face, scratching at his eyes. He cursed, and his weight slipped, and she scrambled out from under him and ran. It took him longer to get up. She didn't look back to see why. Gasping for breath, her throat on fire, she sprinted as hard as she could in the direction of Idlewild, adrenaline giving her a burst of speed. The ground was hard and uneven, her boots kicking through tangles of dead weeds, but for once she didn't put a step wrong. She just ran and ran. By the time she got to the cover of the trees, her chest was on fire, her legs weak. She could hear him shouting behind her, his voice echoing off into the open sky, but she couldn't make out the words. Then, with a chime of terror, she heard the car's engine. He was going to cut her off when she got to Old Barron's Road, and he wouldn't have to do it on foot. Fiona called up the map in her head. She knew every part of this place, every foot of the terrain. She ran past the trees and down through a steep ditch, the bottom soaked with deep, frozen mud, and scrambled up the other side, fighting her way through the undergrowth. Her hands were icy cold. She'd lost her gloves somewhere. She had no memory of it, and her throat burned. But ahead, she saw the south end of the fence that bordered the Idlewild property at the far end of the sports field. She climbed the fence, her numb fingers trying to slip on the chain links, and swung herself over. She put her hands on her knees and gasped for breath like an Olympic sprinter. Her head and neck were alive with pain, the aching so awful it throbbed through her jaw and the roots of her teeth. Saliva filled her mouth, and she spit on the ground, hoping she wouldn't throw up. Garrett would drive back up Old Barron's Road. That meant he planned to either climb the fence or get in through the front gates if he could. The gates were sealed with Anthony Eden's fancy new automatic lock, but Fiona had no illusions that Garrett, who was still fit at 60, couldn't climb a fence. Still, it would take him precious minutes. She had to use them. She started across the field at a quick jog, her legs protesting. The wind blew hard, stinging her ears and her neck, and after a minute she wasn't even surprised to see the detritus of mourning at her feet, the cheap flowers and handwritten notes she'd seen before. "This isn't her place," Lionel had said of the drive-in. But here in Idlewild, this was Mary's place. This was where she walked. Fiona knew she was nearby, the same way she knew that the crows were overhead and that Garrett Creel was on Old Barron's Road. "I'm here," she said to Mary Hand, and kept running.
Chapter 32. Barron's, Vermont, November 2014. It was easier to ignore the flowers and the cards this time, easier to watch her boots scuffle through them and kick them aside as she made her way across the field, now that she knew what Mary was. But the fear didn't go away.
"We were all so horribly afraid," Sarah London had said, but Fiona understood now.
That Sarah London had spent 30 years in this place with this fear, that the girls had lived with it, that Sonia had lived with it, and yet she had come running back, fleeing her killer, dropping her suitcase in the trees, just like Fiona was running back now.
"This place," she thought. "This place."
The garbage underfoot fell away, and she passed the gymnasium, approaching the main building with its rows of teeth.
"Come back," it seemed to say to her, grinning in anticipation. "Come back here as you always have, as you always do, as you always will, over and over. Come back."
She ran toward it without question, drawn to its grinning face. A backhoe was parked in the gravel in front of the main hall, and a pickup truck was parked next to it, but she saw no sign of workers. Whoever it was she had glimpsed before was gone. She shouted, but her voice was only a hoarse whisper, blown away by the wind. She'd seen vehicles here earlier, movement, she was sure of it. Where had they gone? The big black front gates were locked. There was no sign of a security guard. Had Garrett already come and gone, finding no way in? How much time had passed? She had no idea, but when she heard a car's engine approaching from the road, she decided not to chance it. She turned and ran to the front door of the main building, trying to call for help over and over. The front door of the main hall was locked. Fiona stared at the keypad next to it, blinking stupidly, trying to remember the code she'd seen Anthony punch in. She'd watched him do it, watched his fingers move over the keys. If only she could remember. She pulled the memory dimly from her brain and punched in a number combination, her surprise muffled with pain when the light went green and the door clicked open. She slipped inside, closing the door behind her. A car's engine could be heard faintly outside, and she walked hurriedly across the high-ceilinged main hall, her boots scuffing on the dusty floor. Her breath frosted on the air, and there was no sound in here except a rustling in the rafters, birds or bats. How did anyone ever learn in this place, she wondered, as she walked to the bottom of the main staircase. She stared up at the balconies above, spinning away from the staircase like a wheel, and her head throbbed. She pictured Roberta Green here, the young teenager with a braid down her back, wearing the Idlewild uniform from the photographs. Going up and down these stairs, textbooks under her arm, her head down. Wondering when she'd encounter the resident ghost. "She's an echo," Roberta had said. Fiona put a foot on the bottom step, thinking to go upstairs and look for the work crews from the windows, but something stopped her. She turned. A girl stood in the shadows of the west end of the hall, watching her. She was small and slight, her face in shadow. She wore a green and blue plaid skirt and a white blouse, the Idlewild uniform. Fiona's breath stopped. She stood half-turned, her foot still on the step, as the wind blew outside and howled through a hole somewhere in the roof. Dead leaves rustled across the hall's abandoned floor. She looked at the girl's uniform, her size, and even though she'd never seen a photograph, she suddenly knew. "Sonia?" she said, her voice a hoarse croak. The girl didn't move. Slowly, Fiona lifted her foot from the step and backed away from the staircase. She walked toward the girl. "Sonia?" she said again. As she got closer,
She could see the girl's face in the shadows. She had a high forehead, clear gray eyes, a small and straight nose, lips that were narrow and well-formed, a face long and heart-shaped, with a chin as clean as a sculpture's, on a neck that was long and elegant. Her hair was mousy blonde, thin and flat, shoulder-length, pulled back from her forehead with bobby pins. An average-looking girl, with a quiet sweetness and dignity about her, who would someday grow up to be a pretty, strong-featured woman with wisdom in her eyes. Except that she wouldn't, because she'd never make it past 15. She was as real in that moment as if she was truly standing there. She watched Fiona come closer, her expression inscrutable, and then she turned and walked into the shadows. "She's leading me," Fiona thought. She followed. This was the same back corridor Anthony Eden had led her through on their tour so long ago now. It led, Fiona remembered, to a back door to the common. From behind her, she heard the front door rattle as someone tried to open it. She moved quickly. Sonia was gone. Maybe she had given the message she wanted to give. Fiona found the back door and pushed it open, just as she heard the front door rattle again far behind her. She slipped out onto the common and eased it closed behind her. "Where to now, Sonia?" The cold air hit her, and she shivered uncontrollably for a second, her body shaking inside her coat, her teeth chattering. "Quiet. Be quiet. Don't make a noise." Sonia was on the far side of the common, walking toward a building Anthony hadn't taken her to last time. She searched her mind for what he'd told her it was. The dorm. She hurried across the quad after the girl, shaking away the persistent idea that this was madness. It didn't feel like madness. Her throat hurt where Jamie's father had tried to strangle her to death. As flakes of snow hit her hair and her eyelashes, that was what felt like madness. This felt sane. Halfway across the common, she looked back. In one of the windows of the main building, there was a silhouette watching her. A slim girl in a black dress, a veil over her face. "Mary Hand, Mary Hand, dead and buried under land. Good night, girl." Fiona turned and ran faster. The dorm building, unlike the others, was unlocked for the simple reason that the front door was broken. It had been forced off its hinges at some point, the wood rotten, an unintelligible graffiti sign sprayed on the front. Since the restoration had begun, the door had been propped back in place, kept shut by a piece of wood nailed into it and across the door frame. The wood of the frame was so rotted that Fiona pried the board from it easily, the wood splintering like butter beneath her hands. She pushed the door open and walked into a building that had obviously been broken into at least once since the school had closed. Broken bottles, splintered glass, cigarette butts, and even worse garbage littered the floor. An old sleeping bag, crusted with something unspeakable, lay in the corner, shredded nearly to pieces by mice over the years. Charred marks on the floor spoke of at least one fire lit in here. Fiona was grateful when she saw Sonia's shadow flit at the top of the stairs, and she quickly moved past it all and started up. She was nearly at the top, when she heard the gunfire. It was so sudden that Fiona's knees buckled, and she drooped clumsily on the stairwell, gripping the railing. There was one shot, then another, then two, in quick succession. They came from somewhere close outside. The sharp cracks reverberated through her aching head, and she opened her mouth to scream, but nothing came from her tortured throat. Her vision blurred for a minute, and when she realized the shots had stopped, she pulled herself upward again, her shoulders aching. There was no more sound from outside. "Quiet. Be quiet. Hide." She hadn't known Garrett was armed. It was strange that he'd fired shots outside and not at her. Maybe he was shooting at Mary. She moved as quietly as she could down the corridor, blinking in the gloom, looking for Sonia. She saw the girl move through a doorway, silent as a shadow, and followed. The door had a number in cracked, faded paint. 3C. She was in a bedroom. There had been beds in here once, Two sets of bunks by the looks of it, but they were long destroyed, the mattresses gone, the frames splintered and dismantled. An old dresser lay on its side against one wall. The room was musty and smelled like spilled beer and old, cold urine. It had been defaced and defiled and forgotten, but Fiona knew it had been Sonia's room. That was why Sonia had come through the door. If it had been Sonia's room, then it was the room she'd shared with Katie Winthrop, Roberta Green, and Cece Frank. Shivering, Fiona sank to the floor and closed her eyes. This was the room they'd lived in, slept in. She pictured them, though she had no idea what Katie or Cece looked like, wearing their uniforms, talking and teasing one another, and arguing and whispering secrets at night the way girls did. She wondered what secrets had been whispered in this room. She wondered if this was where the girls had felt safe. She couldn't run anymore. She was too tired. Shaking with cold, she lay on the ground, hoping Garrett wouldn't find her. Fiona didn't know she'd drifted off until she opened her eyes. She was looking at the ceiling of the bedroom, but the dark stains in the plaster were gone. The smell of beer and piss was gone. She could hear the wind moaning through the room's only window, but no other sounds. Her body ached too much to sit up, but she turned her head and saw that the bunks were in place, the beds neatly made with green and blue plaid wool blankets over them. A hockey stick leaned against one wall. There was a single wooden chair by the window, and a girl sat in it, her face turned toward the glass. She moved, and Fiona heard a gasping sob come from her throat. It was Deb. She wore the clothes she'd worn the day she was murdered. Her gray raincoat was belted around her narrow waist, though the black knit hat she'd worn when Tim Christopher picked her up was gone. It hadn't been on her body, and it had never been found. Deb's dark hair was pulled back into a loose ponytail, secured at the back of her neck. She looked at Fiona from gray-blue eyes Fiona hadn't seen in 20 years. "Don't let her in," Deb said. Fiona lifted her head from the floor. "Deb," she said. Deb turned back to the window. "She'll ask," she said. Her voice was reedy, as if heard through the blast of a windstorm. "She'll beg. She sounds so pitiful. Don't let her in." I'm hallucinating, Fiona thought, but part of her didn't care. Her sister was beautiful, sitting there with her legs in their dark green pants crossed at the ankles, her feet in the sneakers she'd worn on her date with Tim Christopher. She was quietly, painfully beautiful, forever 20 years old. Her body, dead on the field outside, had still worn those shoes. "Deb," Fiona said again, scrambling to get words out. "Are you all right?" "No," Deb said, still looking out the window. Fiona pushed herself up on her elbows. "Are you always here?" Her sister was quiet for a moment, and then she answered. "Sometimes." She sounded softly confused. "It's all so strange, like a dream, don't you think?" She turned and pinned Fiona with her gray-blue gaze again. "Please don't let her in." "Is it Mary?" Fiona rasped. "It gets so cold out there." Deb looked back out the window. "She sounds so sad." Fiona opened her mouth again, trying to get Deb's attention. She had so much to say, to ask, but her sister couldn't hear. Voices and shouts came from outside. She blinked and the room wavered. "No," she thought. "No." She tried to heave herself up, to touch Deb, perhaps, to grab her, but her body wouldn't cooperate. She tried clumsily to get her knees beneath her, realizing her hands were numb. "No," she rasped out loud. The voices sounded again, closer this time. Shouts! Fiona's leg gave from under her, and she fell to the floor, landing softly on her shoulder, trying to get her arm beneath her. She blinked as the room wavered again.
I was so afraid, Deb said. And then the room went back again to the abandoned shell with its sticks of furniture and awful smell. Fiona lay on her side as tears coursed down her face, cold against her skin. Her teeth chattered. There was the shuffle of fabric, the rustle of a dress in the room. Fiona tried to close her eyes and couldn't. The hem of a black dress came into her line of vision. It moved through the door of the bedroom as Mary Hand came inside. Fiona curled her knees up against her chest, unable to move, unable to scream, unable to run. There was nowhere to go.
I didn't let her in, she whispered to herself. I didn't.
The hem of the black dress swept the dirty floor, the fabric so real Fiona could see the sheen of the thick black silk. Then Mary came toward her, her feet ghastly and visible below the dress's hem. They were bare, icy white and blue with cold, thin skin stretched over bones. Mary took one step and then another. Fiona screamed, the sound nothing but air forced high from her throat. Then she screamed again. There was a shout, and someone came through the door. Two people, three, men. Voices rang through the room. Hands touched her. Fiona turned her head and saw that Mary was gone. She closed her eyes and let them take her.
Chapter 33 Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. It hurt. Everything did. The world came and went. Voices, sounds, hands, hot and cold. Fiona's head was like an overblown balloon, a deafening pounding in her temples. She opened her eyes and saw an unfamiliar ceiling, heard an unfamiliar voice. She closed them again. She woke and realized she was in a hospital bed. It was the middle of the night, and she was alone. She was painfully thirsty. Someone far down the corridor was talking in a low voice, then laughing quietly. She can't get me here, Fiona thought, with a hot wash of relief. And then she fell asleep again. When she woke again, her father was there. Her head was a little clearer this time. Weak sunlight came through the window. It was day then. Malcolm was sitting in a chair next to her bed, wearing a short-sleeved, button-down checked shirt, faded cargo pants, socks, and sandals. A pair of black rubber boots sat by the doorway. He always wore rubber boots in winter, then sandals inside the house. His longish gray-brown hair was tangled and tucked behind his ears, and he wore his half-glasses as he read the newspaper in his lap. He hadn't noticed she was awake yet. Fiona stared at him for a long moment, taking in every detail of him. Dad, she said finally, breaking the spell. He lowered the paper and looked up at her over the tops of his glasses, his face relaxing with pleasure. Fee, he said, smiling. She smiled back at him, though her throat hurt and her lips were cracked.
Am I okay? She asked him.
Well, he folded the newspaper and put it down. You have a lovely case of the flu, mixed with hypothermia, and frostbite was a close call, plus the bruising on your neck. But they say you'll be fine. She struggled into a sitting position, and he helped her, handing her a glass of water from the bedside table.
What happened?
You called me, Malcolm said, smoothing her hair. Remember?
She did, though her memories were disjointed, out of order. I wanted to tell you about Stephen Heyer.
Right. He smoothed her hair again. You left me a long message. I listened to it when I got home from the grocery store. I could tell something was wrong, but I didn't know what the hell to do. While I was pondering it, my phone rang again. This time it was Lionel Charters.
Fiona put down the water glass. Her hand was shaky, but she focused on keeping the glass upright.
Lionel phoned you?
It was the strangest thing, Malcolm said. I've known who he is for years, of course.
You know he runs a kind of informal rehab center in his old trailer. Lionel's son died of an overdose, and ever since then he's let addicts stay with him while they try to dry out. It doesn't always work. They do drugs out there, and they deal, and sometimes there's trouble. But Lionel's intentions are good.
Fiona just sat, listening to his voice as he stroked her hair. "He's an old druggie," she heard Garrett Creel say. "His son blew his brains out with coke." She had so much to say, so many questions to ask, but Malcolm was telling the story, and she was so tired, drifting on his voice. Once Malcolm was on his track, there was no distracting him.
"Lionel is no friend of the media," Malcolm continued, "but he hates the police more. So he called me and said my daughter had just been on his property, looking for Stephen Heyer, that you seemed sick. He said Garrett Creel drove up and pushed you into his car with him, and he drove off."
"He told me," Fiona said, then drummed up her strength. "He was at the drive-in the night Deb died. He told me..."
"I know what he told you," Malcolm said. "I know what Lionel saw."
She tried to swallow hard in her rasping throat. "You knew? About Garrett's cruiser being there?" Her father's hand had stopped stroking her hair. It had gone stiff and tense and still. He looked past her at the wall, his eyes unreadable.
"No," he said, his voice deceptively calm. "But I know now."
He looked, for a second, like the stranger who had been at Tim Christopher's trial, the stranger who had sleepwalked through her parents' divorce. But then his face softened into mere sadness. Fiona wanted to say something, anything. "Dad," she managed.
"Lionel let you get into that car," her father said.
She couldn't tell if it was a question. "He was aiming his gun," she said, "but he couldn't shoot."
"He told me that, too," Malcolm said. "I told him he should have tried harder. Then I hung up on him and called Jamie."
Fiona thought of Jamie's father, his knee in her stomach, his breath in her face. "I knew you would do this." His hands on her throat. She must have tensed, because Malcolm smoothed her hair again. "Where is he?" Fiona said. "Where is Garrett?"
"At the moment," Malcolm said, "I can't quite pinpoint. Likely a holding cell. Or maybe he's talking to his lawyer."
He patted her shoulder as she leaned into him in relief.
"Jamie couldn't reach his father," he said, continuing the story. "And he couldn't reach you. So he got back up and drove to Lionel's place. He found his father's car parked outside the Idlewild gates."
He sighed.
"I didn't go with him, so I only heard secondhand. But from what I know, they went inside, and Garrett shot at them."
"What?" Fiona said, pulling away from him and sitting up. Her head spun.
"Hush, V," Malcolm said. "The shot nicked Jamie's hand, but that's all."
"I didn't know he had a gun," Fiona said. "Garrett must have had it stowed in the car somewhere, probably the trunk, which was why he hadn't used it on her." "Is Jamie okay?"
"He's fine," her father said. "They had to return fire, but no one was hurt. They found you in one of the bedrooms of the old dorm calling for help before you passed out on the floor with his hand marks on your neck. They arrested Garrett, and here we are."
She was shaking. She should call the nurse. They must have her on some kind of medication, something for the pain and the inflammation. She was so tired. "He tried to kill me," she said. "He tried to strangle me in the field off one of the back roads. He was going to kill me and dump me."
"I know," Malcolm said. "The doctors examined your neck. Garrett hasn't talked, but the police will come to take your statement."
"He covered up for Tim, with Helen." The words were jumbling in her head, but she felt the urgency, the importance of getting them out before she sank into sleep again. "I know, honey," her father said again. "You're going to kill him," Jamie had said. There was no going back. not from knowing that Tim could have been stopped before he ever met Deb.
"I'm so sorry, Dad," she said.
He blinked and looked down at her.
"For what?"
he asked.
"I shouldn't have gone," the words coming up through her pained throat. "I should have left it alone. But I thought, I started to wonder whether it was possible that Tim hadn't done it.